We live much of our lives in the borderlands between struggle and hope. One of the absolute certainties in life is that we will struggle. Bad things will happen to us. Loved ones will die or leave us in ways other than death. We will fail and disappoint others and ourselves. Others will fail us. We will make bad decisions. We will get sick. All of these things can happen in life. We know part of life is suffering. Sister Joan Chittister is one of those Catholic nuns today who is not afraid to speak truth to power, especially the power of the male hierarchy in the Catholic Church. She wrote a beautiful and inspiring book, which I'm using a lot in the sermon today, called Scarred by Struggle, Transformed by Hope, and that book is available in our bookstore. In this book, she asserts that the great secret in life is figuring out how to survive life's inevitable struggles without succumbing to them. How to survive life's inevitable struggles without succumbing to them. I think she's right. And not succumbing to struggle does not mean somehow triumphing over struggle. Not succumbing to struggle means that we manage to keep going, that we manage to stay, to keep a seed of hope alive within us, that we manage to keep growing. In contemplating the sermon this week, I found myself thinking often about people who succumb to struggle and in that bleakness attempt to end their own lives. This past Monday was Worldwide Suicide Prevention Day, and a stark reminder that we have a long way to go in preventing suicides. At least two different deaths, apparently by suicide, in our fellowship, family, in friends of fellowship members have touched us here. Just in this past week, families grieving in our fellowship over friends who have died by suicide. And of course, many of us in the fellowship continue to walk in grief 2 years after fellowship member, much loved fellowship member, Ted Marjenka, ended his life by suicide. Suicide is slowly, and I believe thankfully, beginning to emerge from a shroud of secrecy and shame in our society. We are finally beginning to admit the sad truth that too many people die by suicide. Suicide touches almost all of us at one time or another. As it also happens this week, Leah and I attended a program on suicide and suicide prevention put on by the clergy group Common Ground. Doug Bisbee spoke at that. He's the director of the Community of Hope in Oshkosh, which is a suicide prevention nonprofit, a group that also works to support people who have had loved ones die by suicide. And we also have a chapter of that in the Fox Cities. So he shared about suicide, and one of the things he shared is that suicide is not something that a person chooses. It happens when pain exceeds hope for relief. It happens when the struggle overwhelms all sense of the possibility of relief for a person. 90% of people, he reported, who die by suicide have a diagnosable psychiatric disorder, particularly depression. So clearly part of the answer to preventing suicide is to do better in diagnosing and treating people with mental illness. And we have a long, long way to go in this work. The continued prevalence of suicide in our society, I think, also calls each one of us, to familiarize ourselves with the warning signs of suicide. And when we see these warning signs in a family member, in a coworker, in a friend, maybe in ourselves, we need to act. And the best way to act is to reach out for help. Call the county crisis intervention line. If it feels urgent, call 911. The folks on the other end of the phone will help us figure out if this is a true threat, and then they can help us get the person to the right resources in the community. Nationally as well as locally, there's a wonderful suicide prevention training called QPR. QPR stands for Question, Persuade, Refer. Everyone should take it. We've offered it here at the fellowship. I'm sure we will again. It is to suicide what CPR is to heart failure. It saves lives. And if you haven't taken the QPR training, I hope you'll consider doing so. But I don't think that this is all we can do to prevent suicide. There is a spiritual component to suicide prevention as well. And that component is nurturing the seeds of hope within each one of us. Nurturing the seeds of hope is part of the answer to suicide. And finding ways to nurture hope, even in the midst of suffering, is perhaps the single most important and difficult spiritual challenge for each one of us, whether or not we ever have or ever will contemplate suicide. As I think about nurturing hope in the midst of suffering, I think about the story of Jacob with this mysterious person. For me, that story is a metaphor of living in these borderlands between struggle and hope. And it's one of my favorite stories in the Hebrew Bible. It's good to know some of the backstory before this fateful moment for Jacob. So like a lot of characters in the Hebrew Bible, Jacob is far more of a scoundrel than a moral hero. In the narrative just prior to the scene, he has, among other misdeeds, stolen from his brother, deceived his father, fled punishment for these misdeeds, and tricked his father-in-law in order to obtain his fortune. So on this bleak evening, this evening he was attacked, it is easy to imagine Jacob walking along, feeling desperate, feeling alienated, feeling isolated, and feeling far removed from his moral compass. This is a dark night of the soul for him, an unexpected and unwanted moment of reckoning. So Jacob's walking along, his head and his heart full with the knowledge of his mistakes, of his misdeeds. And suddenly, out of nowhere, this mysterious figure assaults him. And this isn't some kind of quick Hollywood fight scene where in a couple minutes it's resolved because we don't have the attention to keep looking. This is something that goes on all night long, hour after hour after hour. And it's a stalemate. Then this mysterious figure wrenches Jacob's hip, trying to pull it out of its socket. "Let me go," the figure then says to Jacob, because he's still hanging on to this figure. "No," Jacob says, "you have to bless me first." That's a really odd request for someone who's been assaulting you for hours. "What's your name?" the mysterious person asks. "Jacob." The mysterious person then blesses Jacob and says, "Now your name is Israel." Jacob then asks the mysterious person, "Well, what's your name?" "You must not ask my name." But really, Jacob doesn't have to ask his name because he knows this mysterious person is a divine being. Really? A divine being? What an arresting and provocative image of the divine. Someone who attacks you, wrestles with you, tries to pull your hip out of its socket. This is not some Hallmark card, namby-pamby picture of God, is it? This is not a God who will give you boatloads of money and success and healing from illness if you only pray well enough or long enough. This is a God who is finely woven into the struggle of life. This image of God says that even when we struggle, we are on holy ground. This is a radical picture of the divine. That's why I love this passage. Well, understandably, this whole episode shakes Jacob to his core. Through the course of this seemingly endless night, he has to be just scared out of his mind. But somehow, he finds the courage to stand his ground. Now, he doesn't win the fight. He endures. And he is blessed by this mysterious being, not because he won, but because he endured. And then Jacob is able to go on. He's wounded, really deeply, deeply wounded. But he goes on to walk with a limp the rest of his life. You cannot escape life's struggles without having some wounds, some scars. Struggle wounds us, sometimes deeply, sometimes forever. And it's folly to think otherwise. So yes, Jacob walks on from this dark night of the soul, wounded for life. But he also walks on as a new and transformed person. This is why he has the new name. He's a new person. And time will show that he's actually a better person. Not perfect, but a better person. Struggle can do this to us. We have the opportunity to walk out of each struggle, not only wounded, but also transformed. And we have the opportunity to walk out of a struggle more of a transforming person who can help other people, who can bring gifts of change to other people around us too. So this is the case for Jacob. In short, the dark night of the soul can, Joan Chittister suggests, become an incubator of light. An incubator of light. I love that image. I'm not suggesting today that all of you should go out and try to find struggle in your life because it brings such amazing gifts. But it does bring such amazing gifts. And when we find ourselves in times of struggle, which we all will, then I figure we might as well try to find the gifts in it amidst the wounding, amidst the hard parts. We might as well try to make the struggle an incubator of a new and transformed self. So for me, the story of Jacob's struggle with this mysterious figure presents a kind of template for how to survive and grow in life's struggles. It's important, the story suggests, to find the courage to keep going, to keep on moving. It's important to hang in there, to persevere. Put one foot in front of the other. Keep breathing. Take it one moment at a time. So what kept Jacob fighting all night long? I believe it was a seed of hope within him. It was a sense that though the struggle was mighty and would probably scar him forever, he would somehow survive it. He would come out wounded, yes, but also still whole and maybe even transformed. And even though the night felt endless and at times the prospects bleak, the dawn would, he believed, eventually come. Hope, Chittister writes, is what sits by the window and waits for one more dawn, even though there isn't an ounce of proof in tonight's sky that it can possibly come. Hope sits by the window and waits for dawn to come. Cultivating seeds of hope within, I think, is an essential spiritual task. And I don't think there's any magical way to do this. I wish there was. It seems to come easier to some people than others. I've noticed some people who seem to keep that seed of hope alive in them, even as life continues to kick them in the you-know-where time after time after time. These are people I really watch because they are teachers. They teach me how to do that, how to survive struggle. One of the tools of cultivating the seed of hope within, I think, is anticipation. That's the theme that we're exploring this month in our services and adult programming. And I realized this week at the Wellspring Wednesday program that, for me, a sort of specific anticipation is actually not all that helpful. For example, as my mother struggled with illness over the last 5 years of her life, I knew that her death was probably not too far off, and I tried to anticipate what it might be like, what it might feel like to me. And that turned out to be just a waste of time. It made me more anxious. It made me more fearful. It was not helpful. Nothing, including my mother's death, ever seems to unfold quite as I expect. So anticipating sort of specific outcomes, to me, it just leaves me disappointed and sometimes deeply perplexed. What helps me instead is a different kind of anticipation. It's the anticipation that even in the bleakest moment, there will always, always be a seed of hope present. There will always be the possibility of new growth. This is a faith statement for this. I believe this. I believe it deeply. So I try to keep my eyes open in times of struggle so I don't miss that seed of hope. I try to keep myself aware that somewhere in this, there's going to be a kernel of goodness and truth and new life. Going back to the story of Jacob for a minute, I don't want to suggest today that our posture and struggle should be to fight like hell. Sometimes it should, but not necessarily always. Paradoxically, hanging in there and persevering sometimes actually involves surrendering and letting go. Chittister tells the story of a woman she knew who fought cancer for 5 years. And then the chemo treatment started to be less effective, the side effects worse and worse. This woman was growing weary of the battle. And so as Christmas approached, she decided to stop the treatments, to enjoy Christmas without the side effects, and to have the chance to be with and to say goodbye to her loved ones. So the new thing that came out of her struggle was surrender, was a letting go, was a saying goodbye. In a different but still important way, she walked out of this struggle a new and transformed person. She walked out at peace, ready to face and to embrace the mystery of death. There is one change I'd like to make in the Jacob story, and since I'm a Unitarian Universalist, what the heck, I might as well. I would make the story a little less solitary. There is some fundamental truth in the idea that ultimately we are alone in our struggles. This is especially true because so many of our struggles are internal. Finding a seed of hope, transforming ourselves, growing, you know, no one else can actually do that for us. But other people around us can support us, they can cheer us on, they can give us suggestions, they can offer us a shoulder to cry on. They can help us actually find the seed of hope within ourselves. So at some point during the story, I wish that Jacob's family had shown up. You know, the same family that he'd been trying to screw right and left for the last month. I wish they would have shown up, stumbled upon the fight. I wouldn't want them to stop the fight or intervene to help Jacob win, because that's not really how it works. But I'd love them to be yelling encouragement, giving him ideas about how he might persevere. I'd love the combatants to take a little time out, you know, to go to their corners where Jacob then could lick his own wounds but also be tended by his family. I think that would be a fabulous twist to the story. And I have to say that part of the reason that I am dedicating a lot of my life to religious community is because I think we all need a place where we have folks in our corner. And I think there's no better place to do that than in religious community. So I'd add to the story, too. In fact, while I'm at it, what I'd add is that there were people from Jacob's fellowship who showed up, too, and supported him. Joan Chittister includes in her book the very moving story of Vedran Smailovic. I shared about this a couple years ago in a sermon, and I keep seeing this picture. Vedran Smailovic was a cellist who lived in Bosnia during the horrible war there. Lost his job because the opera theater where he played professionally was destroyed by bombs. And as the Serbian siege wore on, the people in Sarajevo where he lived, of course, ran out of food. And just getting food became a desperate, desperate activity. One day, as he was looking out the window of his apartment, he saw people lined up at the last bakery in Sarajevo, and then he saw artillery shells hit that line. 22 people died. To show you how desperate people were, the very next day, people showed up again and got in line to get bread. Smailovic felt helpless. He couldn't do anything to stop the violence, but he could do something to bring beauty to this beleaguered city. So that next day, when he saw the people lined up again, he put on his tuxedo and he picked up his cello and a chair and he went down there and he set up next to the line and he started to play. And he played that beautiful, haunting, yet somehow hopeful adagio from Albinoni. And he went back every day for 21 days and played. Chittister writes that this is the story of those who, like Jacob, have wrestled with God and prevailed, hung on, stayed the course, dug down deep into their souls and found life where no life seem to exist. That is the task of hope, she writes, in the face of despair, to find out how much life we can still make with whatever life we have left. So each of us, I think, is somewhere in this borderland between struggle and hope. May we, like Jacob, like Vidrin Smolovic, may we always find a way to keep hope alive somehow. May we each find ways to help our struggles transform us and the world. May it be so.